The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello and good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call coming to you live, hopefully loud and clear, from Singapore, this 27th day of May 2011. Well, just home in on brutal reality. The economic statistic of note that came out 2 days ago was that new orders for manufactured durable goods in April had decreased $7.1 billion, or 3.6%, to $189.9 billion, and that's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. This decrease, which has been down 2 of the last 3 months, followed a 4.5% increase in March. Excluding transportation, new orders decreased 1.5%. Excluding defense, new orders decreased 3.5%. But what's even worse is this. Non-defense new orders for capital goods in April decreased $5.3 billion, or 7.3%, to $67.6 billion. If you subtract the rate of inflation from that number, you actually have a negative reading. All this basically goes to show, actually to prove, that Ben Bernanke's grotesque experiment with money printing was an absolute and total failure. You need look no further. The whole thing cost $600 billion of your money. And it was supposed to rescue the economy. But has Ben Bernanke's huge financial stimulus package, known as quantitative easing 2, actually worked as planned? QE2 is being wound down in the next few weeks. Ben Bernanke has said it has left the economy, quote, moving in the right direction. But an analysis of the real numbers tells a very different story. It turns out the program has created maybe 700,000 full-time jobs at a cost of around $850,000 each. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, to create 700,000 jobs, you, the taxpayer, have paid $850,000 per job created. Thank you very much, Ben Bernanke. House prices are lower than before QE2 was launched. Economic growth is slower. Inflation is higher. Oh yes, it appeared to spark a massive boom on the stock market. Until recently, ordinary investors had started piling back into shares again. And last week, we saw the latest example, the return of animal spirits on Wall Street. A stock in the new dot-com LinkedIn skyrocketed on its debut. But even the stock market boom hasn't been what it appears. An analysis shows that most of the rise in the S&P 500 index under QE2 has simply been a result of the decline in the dollar in which shares are measured. The truth? QE2 has created a massive new bubble in dollar-based financial assets from stocks to gold. Meanwhile, it has had zero visible effect on the real economy. Take jobs. According to the U.S. Labor Department, since last August, the number of full-time workers has gone up by just 700,000, from 111.8 million to 112.5 million, at a cost of $600 billion. As I said, $850,000 per job. And the picture's even more meager. Over the same period, the number of part-time workers has gone down by 600,000. In other words, we've basically shifted 600,000 or 700,000 workers from part-time jobs to full-time jobs. The percentage of the population in work is actually lower today at 58.4% compared to 58.5% last August. The percentage of the workforce in actual work, the so-called participation rate, has fallen by half a percentage point. Some recovery. How do you think the Fed is feeling right now? Ladies and gentlemen, the Fed is desperate. They are in panic mode right now. And it's all thanks to Ben Bernanke's new monetary tools. Specifically, because the Fed now pays interest on reserves held by banks of the Federal Reserve, excess reserves are piling up at the Fed at a phenomenal rate. There are now $1.5 trillion in excess reserves just sitting there that could explode and hit the economy at any time and cause huge price inflation. There has never, ever been so much of an overhang in excess reserves before Bernanke started paying interest on reserves. In the month before the Fed started paying interest on excess reserves, September 2008, excess reserves stood at only $27 billion. Now that figure stands at $1.5 trillion. Let me explain what excess reserves are. Bernanke printed his precious money and lent it to the banks. The banks, as I've explained often here on the show, simply had no use for the money. And so what did they do? They lent it back to the Fed at interest, creating what is known as excess reserves. So the Fed now has all its dirty washing back home, and they simply don't know what to do with it. The incompetence of these people is breathtaking. The Fed has no idea what is going to happen with this $1.5 trillion once it does the system, or how quickly it will flow into the system and cause price inflation, how high they might have to raise interest rates to stop the flow. An alternative the Fed is considering in draining the reserves by getting money market funds to conduct reverse repos with the Fed. This gets a little technical, so just know that if the Fed does reverse repos with money market funds, it will drain reserves from the system. But the money market funds have nowhere near the cash on hand to do the sizable reverse repos with the Fed that the Fed may need to do. The money funds have most of their money in short-term paper that they would be required to sell, or certainly not roll over, if the Fed came to them wanting to do sizable reverse repos. Huge sales of short-term paper would panic the markets. It is a very, very dangerous scenario, and the Fed knows this. When they actually figure this out, I'm not sure, but trust me, they would never have started paying interest on reserves if they had understood the problem back then. So here we are, with $1.5 trillion in excess reserves, with Bernanke not knowing when these might hit the system. And so the Fed desperately continues to add money market funds to the list of those they may in the future do reverse repos with. They're expanding the list, hoping that the larger list, any reverse repos conducted, won't damage the economy. It's total desperation. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin, this is The Wake Up Call, and it is coming through from Singapore via New York City in the good offices of the Progressive Radio Network. And the toll-free number, which it is our pleasure to invite you to use to call us with your questions, rants, comments, and other observations, is 888-874-4888. Once again, the number to call, if you would like to ask a question or lend some value to the proceedings here, which I would love you to do, is 888-874-4888. If you would like to send your questions or your rants or observations by email, you may do so, because I have an email address which is open for you at any moment to send and have it read out to all and sundry. It is as follows: rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, if you'd like to call me in private with your concerns, you can do so. And you should call a area code in Sarasota, Florida, which will carry your call halfway around the world to Singapore. And the number to call is area code 941-441-1682. You may call that number anytime during the day or the night, and the chance is very high that I will pick up at any of the moments of the 24-hour cycle. And once again, the number is 941-441-1682. All right, well, a new book just came out. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I've read lots of information about it. And I also happen to admire very much one of the two people who wrote it, called Gretchen Morgenson, whose writings I will always read. She's very much to the point and worthwhile as an analyst of the current situation. The book is called Reckless Endangerment, and it is an exploration of the origins of the recent financial crisis. And Gretchen is one of the authors. The other is Joshua Rosner. That's Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner. And the book was published just 2 days ago by Times Books. And I couldn't resist bringing to you an excerpt from this, because it's too good to pass up. And hopefully it will encourage you to go out and get yourself some long weekend reading. And the excerpt in question examines the cozy relationship between Alan Greenspan's Fed and the banks the Fed was charged with regulating. So, here we go. To regulators at the Federal Reserve Board, the financial crisis of 1998 and the collapse of the giant hedge fund long-term capital management had been an undeniably terrifying event. Officials at the prestigious New York Fed knew how extraordinary it had been for them to help the hedge fund. They were sensitive to the fact that they had aided in a speculator's rescue and worked hard to downplay their role. In the months and years after the rescue, many officials from the Fed spoke publicly of the lessons to be learnt from the disaster. Chief among them were the dangers of increasingly interconnected world markets and economies, and the threats of institutions that had grown so large that their failures could imperil the entire financial system. "It was a humbling and enlightening experience for us all," said Roger Ferguson, a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, in a 1998 speech touching on the long-term capital rescue. "It should cause all of us to reassess our practices and our views about the underlying nature of market risks." But this advice appears to have been for public consumption only, because it went unheeded, especially within Ferguson's own organization. Indeed, the Fed seemed to have concluded precious little soul-searching as the 1998 crisis receded into the mists of investors' memories. One big reason everyone felt that they could move on from the LTCM mess was the stupendous performance of the stock market, especially the technology sector. It is an investing truth that rising markets create complacency. And in late 1998, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average marching inexorably to the never-before-scaled 10,000 level, investors were especially unfazed. The index of 30 industrial stocks had started off the 1990s at 2,753, but in March 1999, it closed above 10,000 for the first time. It was a bubble that would create tens of billions in losses and considerable angst when it popped in 2000. But while the good times were rolling, top financial regulators like Alan Greenspan exulted over the wonders of technological advancements. Although it was obvious to many that the technology stock mania would end badly, Greenspan and his colleagues at the Fed refused to tamp down the euphoria. They could have raised margin requirements, for example, increasing the amount of their own money investors had to put up to buy stock using borrowed funds. Even as they ignored the stock market bubble, these very regulators were laying the groundwork for a subsequent far more virulent mania in the credit markets, which helped finance, among other things, mortgages and home ownership. Regulators did this by siding with the banks that wanted to loosen the capital strings that bound them too tightly, they thought, in this brave new world. Unfettered capitalism, coupled with the ownership society, where individuals were invited to participate in the wealth creation engine of the financial markets, had become a potent combination. It had produced riches for corporate executives and considerable wealth for individuals, and had replaced federal deficits with an unheard-of government surplus generated largely from taxes paid by investors on their market gains. The belief that the free market could police itself better than any government regulator had already taken hold. So, even as Ferguson and other Federal Reserve officials paid lip service to the important lessons of the 1998 crisis, their actions showed that they ignored those lessons. Instead of heightening the scrutiny of risky practices among the big banks they oversaw, the Fed blocked these institutions' desires to reduce capital requirements and increase their leverage and profits. Instead of reining in financial institutions in areas that could result in losses, the Fed officials loosened them. In other words, the Fed was busy becoming a pushover, not a policeman. It was explicit in those years, if you worked inside the Fed, that you were partners with the banks, said a former Fed official. You were not adversaries. One of the bank's crucial partners at the Fed, albeit behind the scenes, was Ferguson, the vice chairman. From 1997, when he joined the Federal Reserve as a governor, until he resigned to return to the private sector in 2006, Ferguson was a strong advocate for the banks among global financial regulators. President Clinton appointed Ferguson vice chairman of the Fed in 1999. He began his career as a lawyer at Davis, Polk & Wardwell, advising some of the nation's largest banks on mergers and acquisitions, initial public offerings, and syndicated loans. Davis Polk was closely linked to the Fed. Years later, during the financial maelstrom of 2008, the firm would advise the New York Fed on its various bailouts. Ferguson was also the Fed's point man on the Basel Committee, the group of central bankers and international financial regulators that met regularly to discuss and hammer out international banking standards. And, according to those who interacted with Ferguson in this capacity, he consistently pushed for rule changes requested by the nation's largest banks and that were beneficial to them. In 1998, when the Fed governors voted 5-0 to approve the mega merger Citibank and Travelers, Ferguson abstained. His wife, Annette Nazareth, was the managing director at Smith Barney, a Travelers unit, when the application was being considered. In a speech in October 1999 to the Bond Market Association in New York City, Ferguson outlined his preference for less, not more, regulation. And I quote, "Heavier supervision and regulation of banks and other financial firms is not a solution, despite the size of some institutions today and their potential for contributing to systemic risk," he said. "Increased oversight can undermine market discipline and contribute to moral hazard. Less reliance on governments and more on market forces is the key to preparing the financial system for the next millennium." End of quote. A belief had arisen during the late 1990s that bankers had so improved their risk management and loss prediction techniques that regulators could rely on the banks to decide how much extra funding they needed to keep in their coffers in case of a financial downturn, a surplus guided by regulatory measurements known as capital standards. Not everyone agreed that it was prudent to rely on the banks themselves for guidance. Certainly, the FDIC rejected the notion. But the Fed was among those regulators who were more than willing to put the bankers in the driver's seat. Others were the Office of Thrift Supervision, which oversaw savings banks, and the Comptroller of the Currency, which scrutinized large national banks. Executives at the big banks knew that their profits would be bolstered if they could reduce the amount of money regulators required them to set aside for problem loans. Smaller set-asides meant more money to be deployed in lending or purchases of income-producing securities. Banks also recognized that higher profits meant loftier executive pay. But reducing capital requirements would also leave the banks in a more perilous position if their loans and investments went bad. And thanks to the elimination of Glass-Steagall, banks were now allowed to extend and expand their operations almost without limits. Such expansion increased the likelihood of losses in the years ahead. The Fed bought into the bank's argument that because losses and bank failures had been rare during the mid to late 90s, this was evidence that these institutions had become better at managing their risk-taking. Top Fed officials ignored one of the most basic lessons in economics, that even though the sun may be shining today, you should set aside money for the inevitable rainstorm. Others, such as Chairman Greenspan, seem to have consciously decided that because it rained so infrequently, it wasn't worth discussing such an outcome. In a 2000 speech, he said, "We have chosen capital standards that by any stretch of the imagination cannot protect against all potential adverse loss outcomes." There is implicit in this exercise the admission that, in certain episodes, problems at commercial banks and other financial institutions, when their risk management systems prove inadequate, will be handled by central banks. In a May 2002 speech in Lexington, Virginia, Ferguson weighed in. "Any regulatory capital standard must require banks to hold an amount of capital sufficient to get them through, not the worst imaginable, but less rough times. Competition within the industry and among banking systems of different countries often presses for less. Such pressures must be resisted." But internally, at meetings in which the new standards were discussed among regulators and market participants, granting the bank's wishes seemed to be the Fed's priority, according to a regular attendee. The Fed concluded that regulators could use banks' own risk metrics to devise capital requirements because the regulator started from the position that these institutions had learnt to estimate losses more reliably than they had in the past. To some outside the Fed, relying on banks' figures represented at best a delegation of important oversight. and at worst, a dereliction of duty. We're going to the industry to get a lot of data, the fellow regulators. They were calibrating their formulas off the bank's data. The Fed would have been hard-pressed to even come up with the estimates because only the banks really had the data. Some regulators argued that instead of relying on banks' estimates of future loss, a better approach would be to determine capital requirements using actual losses banks had experienced in the 1980s. Applying those real and painful losses to the equation, officials at the FDIC concluded that the new capital requirements left little room for error if banks experienced losses outside their own estimates. The Fed's worldview was dominated by the big banks, the fellow regulator said. If you look back at all the things that were done, all the rulemaking was in the same direction. That the banks knew what they were doing, and we needed to rely more on their internal systems. This view came through loud and clear in meetings of the New York Fed's wood-paneled boardroom, where regulators and the big banks discussed the new capital requirements. According to a regulatory official who attended these meetings, the message transmitted to the banks was to fear not. The Fed was on their side. At one of the first meetings I went to, this official said, there were people from the highest levels of all regulatory agencies, mostly and staff, along with chief risk officers of 10 banks. The banks were told point blank the changes were going to be attractive from a capital standpoint. Although after the financial crisis occurred, Ferguson denied that he and others at the Fed had transmitted a dual message, its existence could not have been clearer to participants in these meetings. In public speeches at congressional hearings, federal officials insisted that it had no interest in reducing capital requirements. But behind the scenes, the message to the banks was an emphatic, "We understand where you're coming from, and we're on your side," one participant said. The Fed also angered its fellow regulators by maintaining a disturbing secrecy about the figures and formulas it was using to come up with the new capital requirements. According to people involved in the discussions, the Fed repeatedly pushed back against the FDIC's desire to publish tables showing the range of effects capital changes would have on different institutions. These tables showed how the big banks benefited from the proposed rule changes far more than the small banks did. When you publish a bunch of formulas with a lot of Greek letters, it's hard to understand what that means, said one regulator involved in the battle. They didn't want to risk having the small banks get wind of the differences and raising a stink on Capitol Hill. The FDIC prevailed, however, and the tables were included. As it happened, the credit crisis hit before many of the changes suggested by the Basel Committee and backed by the Fed could be implemented. But as banks wrote down hundreds of billions in bad loans and sought on-the-fly ways to press for accounting changes that would protect them from writing down hundreds of billions more, it was evident relying on the bank's loss estimates to reduce capital requirements would have been a disastrous decision. It would have made the crisis even more devastating than it was. The Fed's determinedly bank-centric approach in the years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis meant banks were dangerously undercapitalized just when they most needed large cash cushions to protect against losses. But even after it had become clear that the Fed had been wrong to push for relaxed capital standards, the regulator continued to take a pro-bank worldview in its various rescues of big banks hobbled by bank credit decisions. Wow. Sounds good. Almost feel like buying the book myself. We shall see. Ladies and gentlemen, you know the problem, quite frankly. The problem is that economics courses simply do not discuss the eventualities of what will happen in a crisis such as we have seen. Go through any of the economics textbooks and you'll find nothing but polyamor situations discussed, with the occasional lip service paid to the mild kind of recessions we've seen so often in the past. The situation that we've experienced has no guideline. There is nothing in the books that tells you what to do. Just like a plane flying through the sky and has a malfunction, and the pilot has never been taught how to deal with the situation, and of course the plane crashes into the ground. And this is the problem with economics, and this is why the Austrian school of economics is so valuable and so often ignored, because people don't want to think about the bad outcomes. They're so arrogant, so conceited, so self-absorbed, that they think, not to worry, whatever happens, we'll find a way out, because we are all omnipotent. And as we are about to find out, we are not all omnipotent, and the Fed especially is not all omnipotent. And as I've told you, this question of QE2 would never work. It would never produce the desired effect. It hasn't done so. And Bernanke today must be a very, very worried man. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, somehow managed in double quick time to arrive at the halfway mark here, so I suppose we'd better just take a break and have our little promos, and then I'll be right back.
The Progressive Radio Network, filling your day with progressive moments.
I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. We're proud to announce that the Progressive Radio Network will be bringing you our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, every Monday afternoon starting June the 6th from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Mark your calendars and save up your questions so you can ask us about possible strategies for your health problems, whether mainstream or complementary and alternative.
We also invite your questions and comments about any area of health care, including politics, economics, ethics, philosophy, and styles of healthcare.
So remember to tune in every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to the Progressive Radio Network's Prescriptions for Health show.
Are you asking questions about the fate of our planet, your spiritual direction, and how to find meaning in a fast-paced society? Voices of Wisdom with John Jeanette is here to answer those questions and more. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear sacred activists and teachers exploring the meaning of contemporary culture. The show is produced by Wisdom University with regular commentary by Jim Garrison and Will Tagle. I'm your host, John Jeanette, and I look forward to your questions.
Want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
Gary Nall. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
News anywhere on the internet. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com, your number one source for everything progressive.
Okay, I think we're back. Let's just have a look at some of the things that American presidents can do today on their own without recourse to the government or to any official body, entirely at liberty to do these things. Order assassinations, including American citizens, operate secret military tribunals, engage in torture, enforce indefinite imprisonment without due process, order searches and seizures without proper warrants, gutting the Fourth Amendment, ignore the 60-day rule for reporting to the Congress the nature of any military operations as required by the War Power Resolution, continue the Patriot Act abuses without oversight, wage war at will, treat any and all Americans as suspected terrorists at ports with CSA groping and nude X-raying. And by the way, the Federal Reserve accommodates all this by counterfeiting the funds needed and not paying for paid for by taxation and borrowing, permitting runaway spending, endless debt, and special interest bailouts. Well, starting next year, all new cell phones will be required to contain a chip that will allow the president to broadcast called emergency alerts to the cell phones whenever the president wants. Cell phone users will not be allowed to opt out of the presidential messages. The following is how a CBS News report describes the new system. A new national alert system is set to begin in New York City that will alert the public to emergencies via cell phones. It's called the Personal Localized Alert Network, or PLAN. Presidential and local emergency messages, as well as amber alerts, would appear on cell phones equipped with special chips and software. Well, the UK has more surveillance cameras per citizen than anywhere else in the world. According to one estimate, there are 4.8 million video cameras constantly watching every move citizens make. And remember, the UK is one-fifth the size of Texas. A so-called certified TSA official was brought in to oversee student searches at the Santa Fe High School bomb last weekend. Will this kind of thing soon be happening at every high school in America? The U.S. Department of Agriculture is spending huge amounts of money to install surveillance cameras in the cafeterias of public schools so that government control freaks can closely monitor what the children are eating. And the following is how a recent article posted on Infowars.com describes this new program. Billed as part of an effort to reduce obesity and improve eating habits, small cameras programmed to take snapshots of lunch trays before and after each student eats. Each child is uniquely identifiable via a barcode attached to the tray. The amount of calories and nutrients that each child has consumed is then calculated by a database containing 7,500 different varieties of food. The EU is spending hundreds of millions of euros on propaganda campaigns in an attempt to convince the citizens of Europe that the EU is good for them. Today, FBI surveillance teams regularly employ warrantless GPS tracking to monitor the movements of peaceful activists, even if they are not suspected of ever committing a crime. The Obama administration is fighting in court to keep this practice legal. According to FBI Director Robert Mueller, homegrown terrorists, so-called, represent as big a threat to American national security as Al-Qaeda does. Federal VIPR teams, that's V-I-P-R, are establishing a series of internal checkpoints all across the United States. The following is how a recent article by Paul Joseph Watson described these VIPR team activities. The TSA has announced its intention to expand the VIPR program to include roadside inspections of commercial vehicles, setting up a network of internal checkpoints, and rolling out security procedures already active in airports, bus terminals and subway stations to roads and highways across the United States. Oh, by the way, who exactly decided that it would be a good idea to call them Viper teams? What's next? Are we going to find out that the TSA has hired Cobra Commander and Destro as consultants? Thousands of so-called dysfunctional families in the UK are being subjected to intensive 24-hour surveillance to make sure that their children attend school, go to bed on time, and eat proper meals. U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer says that Amtrak have a no-ride list similar to the no-fly list used at U.S. airports. Before you can get on an airplane today, your name is checked to make sure it is not on any international watch lists. So what do you have to do to sit on an international watch list? Nobody really knows. What's next? A no-breathe list? UK authorities are now admitting that every phone call, text message, email, and website visit made by private citizens will be stored for 1 year and will be available for monitoring by government agencies. The amount of cell phone surveillance that goes on is absolutely staggering. For example, one German politician named Malte Spitz recently went to court to force Deutsche Telekom to reveal how often his cell phone was being tracked. What he found out was absolutely amazing. It turns out that in just 1 6-month period, Deutsche Telekom recorded the longitude and latitude coordinates of his cell phone 35,000 times. DARPA has now developed new video surveillance technology that warning will bring about the end of public anonymity. The following is how the Extreme Tech blog is describing this new technology. To be in public is to be on camera, but most video footage is discarded, as only so much can be sorted and analyzed. Until now, DARPA has created a technology that can index and analyze video in real time, marking the end of anonymity in public places. Well, in the UK, which is competing with the US, it seems to me, to be rigidly invasive in everybody's lives, it is now illegal to it is illegal to photograph the police for any reason whatsoever. Police in the UK have purchased software that will enable them to easily follow the digital footprints of virtually anyone. The following is how a recent news report in the UK described this new software. The Metropolitan Police has bought GeoTime, a security program used by the US military, which tracks suspects' movements and communications and displays on a three-dimensional graphic. The software aggregates information gathered from social networking sites, GPS devices like the iPhone, mobile phones, financial transactions, and IP network logs to build a detailed picture of an individual's movements. In Tacoma, Washington, a seventh grade student was recently questioned by the Secret Service about a message that he posted on his Facebook page. Be very careful about what you put up on Facebook or Twitter. The entire world can see it. According to the ACLU, state police in Michigan are using extraction devices to download data from the cell phones of motorists that they pull over. This is taking place even if those pulled over are not accused of doing anything wrong. The following is an article on CNET News describing the capabilities of these extraction devices. The devices, sold by a company called Cellebrite, can download text messages, photos, video, and even GPS data from most brands of cell phones. The handheld machines have various interfaces to work with different models and can even bypass security passwords and access some information. Last year, one shocking poll found that 51% of Americans agree with this statement. It is necessary to give up some civil liberties in order to make the country safe from terrorism. unbelievable. The MPAA and RIAA have submitted their master plan for enforcing copyright rights to the new Office of Intellectual Property Enforcement, and it includes installing spyware on everyone's computer that would detect and delete any infringing materials. The UK's new internet law includes a three strikes rule that allows your entire family to be cut off from the internet if anyone who lives in your house is accused of copyright infringement with proof or evidence or trial. How would you like to have your face scanned and your ID recorded every time you attend a public event? The San Francisco Entertainment Commission is actually proposing a new rule which would, quote, require all venues with an occupancy of 100 people or more to record the faces of all patrons and employees and scan their IDs for storage in a database which they must hand over to law enforcement on request. End of quote. The Obama administration is developing a universal Internet ID program that would watch law enforcement, watch, track, monitor, and potentially control your activity on the Internet. These trusted identities, so-called, are being touted as a way to increase safety and security on the Internet and as a way to eliminate the need for dozens of different usernames and passwords. As I've mentioned previously, the internet kill switch is rapidly becoming one of the favorite new tools of tyrannical governments all over the globe. Once upon a time, the internet was a bastion of liberty and freedom, but now nation after nation is cracking down on it. In fact, legislation has been introduced once again in Congress that would give the President of the United States an internet kill switch that he would be able to use in the event of war or emergency. Of course, there would be a whole lot of wiggle room in determining what actually constitutes a true emergency. The members of Congress that are pushing this internet kill switch bill want the U.S. to become more like China in this regard. Well, one of the most liberty-killing pieces of legislation in recent years was the damnable Patriot Act. Unfortunately, the vast majority of Republicans and the vast majority of Democrats will never vote against the renewal of this hideously invasive piece of outrageous legislation because they don't want to look soft on terrorism. About the only U.S. senator to stand up against the Patriot Act is Rand Paul. He is doing all he can to fight a one-man battle against the Patriot Act, but Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid did his best to extend the Patriot Act without any debate taking place. Top Democrats are attempting to claim that even debating the renewal of the Patriot Act provisions would endanger national security. Of course, most Republicans aren't going to stand in the way because they absolutely love the Patriot Act. If you display the so-called wrong political message on your car, look forward to finding law enforcement officials cracking down on you. A 73-year-old Virginia resident was recently kicked out of a national park for displaying a sticker promoting Ron Paul's campaign for liberty on his car. Let me read an excerpt from a recent Rutherford Institute report about this incident. The Rutherford Institute has come to the defense of a 73-year-old Virginia resident who was allegedly ordered by a park ranger to remove his car from a national military park in South Carolina because of political messages attached to his vehicle. Jack Four, whose ancestors fought in the historic battle memorialized at Kings Mountain National Military Park, contacted the Rutherford Institute after being told by a park ranger that the decal promoting a political organization associated with Representative Ron Paul, which was displayed on the back window of Four's car, was not allowed in the park. Well, brutal crowd control techniques are not just for major events anymore. Recently, riot police in Illinois used tear gas, LRAD sound weapons, and crowd suppression tactics against a bunch of college students that were just blowing off some steam at a year-end block party at Western Illinois University. Well, You better know that the U.S. government is gathering more information on all of you than ever before. According to a recent article in the Baltimore Sun, every 6 hours, the volume of information that the NSA gathers is equivalent to the entire Library of Congress. Nobody is anonymous anymore. The truth is that the U.S. government and major corporations have more information about you than you probably ever dared to imagine. And then you wonder why I'm suggesting that you leave the country, ladies and gentlemen. Unbelievable. Okay, a couple of emails before we conclude. From Johnny Jones. Hi, Richard. Thank you for your show. It is an invaluable resource. Recently, you stated that commodities will drop, including gold and silver, due to the deflationary environment. I feel precious metals will continue upward due to crumbling currencies and uncertainty. Comments? Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, things are moving very fast in our world, and indeed it is true that economies are crumbling, currencies are crumbling. I have to tell you that we are at the cusp of a giant and major meltdown to the entire global system, in my opinion. You absolutely need to be aware of this and to know what precautions you need to take if and when this happens, because this will come coincident with an enormous increase in crime, in my opinion. And you do want to be aware of it, because when it happens, you will be confronted by a completely new situation that you have never had to deal with before. We will discuss this as things become more and more evident as time goes by. But I think as far as precious metals are concerned, they will not help you. You will not find yourself able to buy food in a supermarket with a lump of gold. And so I would be very cautious indeed about assuming that the price of metals is going to go sky high. I am not so convinced that that will happen. In real terms, in terms of other goods and services, the price of gold may be very high, higher than it has ever been, maybe even double the value that it is today, but that is not necessarily consequential upon a huge rise in the price of those things. Please be aware and take it accordingly. So that's my answer to you, Johnny, and I hope it is of some help. Steve Kruger had a nice little rant, which I thought I would bring to your attention. Richard, I don't know if I have this right. If the Federal Reserve is the prime buyer of Treasury debt under QE2, and this comes to a screeching halt in June, just who is expected to pick up the slack? It seems to me that the Federal Reserve is acting like a shill to bring in other buyers. When this is over, what will entice people to buy the debt of a nation that is some $14 trillion in debt with a declining GDP and increasing unemployment? With Treasury paper currently in the 1% to 3% range, to me, the reward ratio looks out of line. I would think interest rates should rise to between 6% and 8% and raise rather quickly. What say you? What the Federal Reserve is doing is exactly the same as a private citizen who is buried in debt does. He takes his current charge card bill, opens another charge card, then pays off the first with a new one. For an individual, this works like a charm, providing you die before you run out of new charge card companies. As far as this working for a nation, I think June has become our last charge card. I guess the real question is, how the hell does this end? Another annoying question, if there is a shortage of Treasury debt buyers and the government has no more gold to confiscate, Roosevelt and Nixon, America had wealth tied up in IRAs. Would you think that at some point they would come after this mountain of cash? Our leaders are desperate and have no real plan of action. Expect anything at any time from the trapped rats that are in charge. Steve Kruger. Yes, Steve, I think you've pretty much answered your own question. I mean, I don't know that the government will come after the IRAs, because, quite frankly, the last thing the government wants to see is an open revolt on its hands. So I think that they will confine themselves to activities which don't really precipitate a mass outbreak of unrest, which taking away the IRAs would most certainly do. They don't want to do that. I don't think that that is likely to happen. So certainly in the initial stages, I wouldn't worry about that. But as I said to you just now, we are really in the initial stages of something which is absolutely untraveled. We are going along a path completely untrod, and there is no real knowing what people might do under those circumstances. All I know is that those who are alert will move. And all those of you who say that going to South America is a bad idea because it's unstable, please try to understand that these countries are different. The South American countries are not all to be stamped with one branding. You take Costa Rica, for example, a very calm country, much calmer than the United States, much more stable than the United States. The Costa Rican government has not provided an army. There is no army in Costa Rica. I mean, that tells you something about the place. They're a very calm, very measured people. They have no fear of social unrest. They are an absolutely ideal country for people who want to leave the United States to go to. And there are plenty of other such countries. I merely mention Costa Rica because Costa Rica happens to be a country close to the United States and easy of easy access to any of you who might feel inclined to go there. So I wouldn't worry about several countries in Latin America. Even Panama is extremely quiet. I think Colombia is not going to be anything like as volatile as it was before. They've had their 30 years of volatility, unrest, crime, done with that. I think they want peace. I think that will be the place to be. I wouldn't concern myself necessarily about the dangers of, you know, Central and South America as painted by one stroke of the brush. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you are about to embark upon a three-day weekend. Some of you will go to the beach, some of you won't, but I am hoping that you will all have a wonderful time by the beach or in your chosen place of recreation, and I wish you all the best, and there will not be a of Monday. In fact, a holiday for PRN as well as for you. And so I will be back next Friday, same place, same time. And I thought I would leave you with a song from Alabama, singing about the workers working the 40-hour week. So with that, I will bid you a wonderful weekend. Take care, and I will see you again next Friday. Bye-bye.
There are people in this country who work hard every day. Not for fame or fortune do they strive, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay. And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time. Just send it on down the line. Hello, Pittsburgh steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just send it on down the line. This is for the one who swings the hammer, driving home the nail. For the one behind the counter, ringing up the sale. For the one who fights the fire, the one who brings the mail. For everyone who works behind the scenes, you can see them every morning in the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns. Working together like spokes inside a wheel, they keep this country turning around. Hello, Kansas, Wheatfield farmer, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on.
spirit you can't replace with no machine. Hello, oh.